Hello and welcome to the Herb Doctor podcast with myself, Katrina Hegarty,
and Dr. Dailish Clare. Hi, Dailish, how are you?
Good. All good.
Are you enjoying the nice dry weather we're having?
Lovely, bright, dry, and no gale force winds.
No, and it's crisp as well. It's kind of crisp. So what are you discussing on this podcast today?
On this podcast today, we're going to think about evidence and alternatives.
Ooh, okay.
Okay. So not alternatives, alternatives.
Alternatives.
Yeah. This is a herbal term that you won't find in the dictionary until we bring it back into use again.
Right.
So so that's to look forward to. Anyway, so the reason why I'm doing this podcast the way around I'm doing it is that inevitably when I speak to people about herbal medicine, they say, yeah, but where's the evidence? Right. And I'm going, and I know where the question is coming from, because for the first 3 years of learning about herbal medicines, I kept on saying, where's the evidence? Where's the evidence? Where's the evidence? And it took a long time to realize, and lots of layered kind of understanding of why the evidence is as it is. All right. There is very little clinical evidence based on patients. There is a considerable amount of it, but there's comparatively little. Then there are evidence from human studies using volunteers. And then there's evidence from animals. And then there's evidence from laboratory studies in a Petri dish or on cell lines. Now, that's one form of evidence. That's the form of evidence that is applicable to what is self-described by establishment medicine as the gold standard of double-blind, randomized controlled clinical trials, where you have a number of people with a condition and you give randomly select half of them. The groups are comparable in all different age, you know, weight, whatever, gender, you know, all different cofactors. And you give one treatment, which is not differentiated by the patients to the other one. And you see whether there's an improvement in the group that have the treatment and the group that don't. So you have a patient group that are uniform and they have one condition. And they're usually not people who have other conditions, or they're often men. They're often, because women might get pregnant. And that would be a confounding factor or a risk to the patient. So they're usually men, usually between the ages of 18 and 45, because after that, people are getting more comorbidities. So that's a big differentiating or kind of limiting factor in itself. You have to have a big study in order for it to be construed as being applicable to the whole population, or multiple studies. These are extremely expensive, extremely, extremely expensive. Another limitation is that they are now usually performed in less industrially developed, wealthy countries, and they're being done in countries that have a poorer economy because they're less expensive there. And they ask one question, and the answer has to be quantitative, right? So it either has to lower the blood pressure by a certain amount, right, to be clinically significant. And the clinical significance is accepted as what's called a P factor. But that P factor just doesn't tell you whether the evidence works or not. It just tells you that if you repeat this experiment, you're likely to get the same effect. All right. So there is no evidence that something actually works. There's just a thesis which is either supported that this will reduce this number or factor or whatever, which has to be able to be counted. So that needs to be push physiology, biochemistry as significant, like it's a shove, right, over a short period of time, because these are very expensive, right? So along come the herbs, and they aren't one substance. They're usually five or six substances, according to traditional practice. They're given to people with all kinds of backgrounds, other morbidities, other whatever. They've been doing so for 40,000 years, most likely. They are from the natural world. They are not invented chemicals that have only recently been introduced. and they don't necessarily shove quantitative factors in a particular direction in a short period of time. So I would say that even if you do clinical studies, a double-blind clinical control study is not necessarily the best way of assessing whether herbs work. Neither is that a level of certainty necessary, because the likelihood of significant toxicity is a lot less. There are lots of herbs that people, that qualified herbalists, use with great deference to their effects, because we have learned over those many thousands of years that these are herbs to be used only for very significant clinical conditions and only for the least amount of time possible, unless they are necessary to actually maintain function. And that's safer than not taking them, right? But that is a very small proportion of herbal medicine, and it can be managed by other appropriate regulation. Okay. I told you it was complex, didn't I? But there is evidence, and I'm going to give you an example of where evidence matches the kind of empirical evidence over the generations. All right, so I want to take a specific example. We're also going to compare some of the alternatives. And we're also going to kind of mention that it, something might be indicated for particular clinical issues, but with herbal medicines, they might have additional effects that have potential benefits for a wider application. Okay, so I'm going to look at a study. This will be, the references will all be available in the transcript. This study was designed to examine the effect of burdock root tea. Right, so this is what a herbalist would use. Now, a herbalist would usually use burdock root tea alongside other herbs, but that's fine. This is still a very nice study. So it's to examine the effect of burdock root tea on inflammatory markers and oxidative stress indicators in patients with knee arthritis. So we're looking for very scientific objectives there. We're looking for things that you can count, because that's what this kind of evidence is good for. But they're very specific things. This isn't asking a patient to fill in a questionnaire as to how they experience their pain, right? So it's a lot less subjective. So I thought that was why it would appeal to those people who are going, give me the evidence. And I'm kind of going, here you go, here's the evidence. So 36 patients between 50 and 70 years old with knee arthritis were referred to a rehabilitation department of a hospital. They were selected and randomly divided into two groups. Anthropometric measurements included height, weight, and body mass index for all individuals along the 42-day study period. The same drug treatments, including two lots of 500 milligrams of acetaminophen, which is paracetamol in this side of the world, twice a day, and one glucosamine were considered, right? So they had the same treatment program in both groups. The intervention group received three cups of burdock root tea a day, with 2 grams of burdock and 150 mils of boiled water a half an hour after their meal. The control group received three cups of boiled water at the same time each day. They looked at high sensitivity CRP, an inflammatory marker, interleukin 6, IL-6, an inflammatory marker, oxidative stress indicators such as total antioxidant capacity, glutathione peroxidase, and superoxide dismutase, and thiobarbituric acid reactive substances before and after the intervention. So results showed that the burdock tea significantly decreased the levels of the interleukins, the CRP, the malondialdehyde, while the serum levels of TAC and activities of the SOT, these are the ones that I read out previously, all of those five or six markers were all significantly increased. The GPX, which is the glutathione peroxidase activities, increased, but not to clinical significance. Conclusions. The results suggested that Artium Lapa root improves inflammatory status and oxidative stress in patients with knee osteoarthritis.
Great.
Great. I think all of our patients should be on this treatment. So one would think that you all trip over burdock in your hedgerows, right? If you live in that belt across Europe, North America, it's the kind of herb that would also grow when I was in Tibet. This is like nettles, but people don't recognize it. It's just part of the greenery. What you might recognize is the seeds. The seeds are what are called beggar's buttons, and they are the biological inspiration for Velcro. Because what they do is they have little burrs that cling onto people's clothes, and then they're, you know, ripped off and thrown away. And that's how humans and animals are very good at helping nature disperse seeds. There's a big problem with this study. There's only 43 patients.
Okay.
But they're men and women. They're on the right age group. And all of the results were clinically significant. No problem tolerating it. So you're kind of going, oh, they should do a much bigger study, shouldn't they?
Yeah, why aren't they?
That was 2016. It's 9 years later and we still don't have them. Is anybody going to get rich on burdock tea? I would think not. And you might think, is there any other evidence? Well, I've also included references for two reviews of the pharmacological effects of burdock and another review of the phytochemicals and biological activities of burdock. So we have a lot of life sciences. We have other supporting evidence. So I would suggest that if any doctors are listening to this, that they suggest that their patients drink a cup of 2 grams of burdock tea 3 times a day and see how they get on. Yes. So now we come to, well, is this something that herbalists hadn't thought of before we did this research? No, because if we look at the research of herbal medicine, the research into herbs are always based on traditional practice. They didn't just pick any old bush from the hedgerow and go, oh, I wonder if that works in arthritis. No, they asked the herbalists. Well, they didn't. They just read the books. There's very, very rarely are the herbalists involved in these kinds of planning, these kinds of studies, which is a big problem because many of the clinical studies, the results could be, the outcomes could be much better fine-tuned to the probable outcomes based on the experience of a clinical herbalist, right? I'll often see studies where it says that such and such a herb does not increase the iron levels in a patient on chemotherapy.
I see, right? Yeah.
And I'm kind of going, yeah, I wouldn't expect it to. You know, it would take a lot longer than the 6-week trial. It would be, it's too big a jump. It's too harsh a push for either one herb or while somebody is on ongoing chemotherapy, which is having an opposite effect. But many of these studies then give herbal medicine a bad name. You know, oh, it doesn't work in these circumstances. Well, it might if you gave it over 12 weeks rather than 6 weeks. It's very frustrating when you realise.
It sounds like.
Yeah. There's one particular study on echinacea, which does not support the use of echinacea for coughs and colds. And beautiful study, really good size study group, really good product, a really good lots of things. And it in the end, the conclusion was that it didn't work. And I'm kind of going, oh, that's a shame. Echinacea doesn't work. I got the full article and realized that what they had done is they advised, this was in children, they advised parents to wait until children had 3 symptoms of a respiratory tract infection before starting the echinacea. Any herbalist would say, and all of the clinical experiences, that you intervene at the first sign of the runny nose. Or, you know, what, where my Auntie Eileen would look at a child and go, that child is coming down with something. That's when you start the echinacea. So, and it was such a shame because it was one of the best clinical studies in terms of methodology that there is of echinacea. But now it's on the record that it doesn't work in children, which isn't my clinical experience. So we're recognizing that this research was inspired by traditional herbal medicine. And we're going to look at a group of herbs called alteratives. And these are herbs that alter the condition in a tissue by eliminating metabolic waste via the liver, the large intestine, the lungs, the lymphatic system, the skin, and the kidneys.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. And this is the beauty of the herbs. You're not asking them to do something in the ears or in the kidneys or in the digestive tract. all of the herbs, but these particular herbs are renowned for having a clearing and eliminating factor. They're also called blood cleansers or depuratives. Examples include burdock root, dandelion root, cleavers, also poke root. And that's an example of one that would be, I would say, that herbalists would use with great caution and for a short period of time. And then nettle leaf. These are just examples, okay? There's another, this is a quote from Sebastian Pohl, if anybody knows the herb teas, Pukka teas. That would be his body of work would be, and those very good quality teas. Another description is by Elizabeth Brooke, and she's a well-known author and clinical medical herbalist. And she describes alteratives as blood cleansers, remedies which act as body purifiers. You can almost get a taste for it with the nettles. You've been drinking nettle tea with me, Katrina. And it gives that very clean sense to your palate. So my current understanding is that they alter the condition of the tissue by eliminating metabolic waste, clearing old morbid accumulations in the tissues to facilitate healing. So even if somebody has an acute medical problem, to clear out all the backlog is a good idea. You know, to get everything moving so that the body can have a clean inflammatory or healing reaction, which can then come to an end. The biggest problem, and it's one of the problems I see with antibiotics, is that the antibiotics kill thousands of bugs that weren't part of the sepsis or infection. And then that leaves a lot of morbid material to be cleansed, which is why often people find that they have an infection that's treated with antibiotics, and then it takes them quite a while to recover their energy and to feel well in themselves again. Now, this isn't antibiotics. This is unnecessary antibiotics. And I join forces with lots and lots of doctors and the World Health Organization and all the doctors' organizations. So clearing old morbid. Now, this is also important because we want to detox the tissues of xenoestrogens, herbicides, PCBs, all the things that nobody can avoid, right? These are in our furniture, our curtains, our everything. We are surrounded by toxins. This is indisputable. This is indisputable as the damage from smog in the 1930s. It just is. We just can't see it.
But it's there.
But it's there, all right? And we certainly, you know, whatever you put it down to, we have an absolute pandemic of chronic illness and metabolic disease. So how I picture it for myself is that they stimulate the delivery from the intracellular and extracellular fluid to the lymph. So we have accumulations inside the cell, and then we have accumulations that gather in the fluid between the cells, and we need them to be pushed in the direction of the collection system for the lymph.
Okay.
And that's how I see the alteratives working. They're also an adjuvant treatment for the breakdown, elimination of breakdown products of herbs and drugs, especially via the bile, right? Where we have a re-entering circulation, which if we don't have enough bile, can be a hindrance to healing. We're talking about clearing hindrances to resolving inflammation. I like that one, actually. Yeah. I've just made that one up. Elimination of breakdown products of all overstimulated metabolism in chronic conditions. For example, if you have chronic inflammation like arthritis or an autoimmune disease or chronic allergies, then you're constantly breaking down tissue, which needs to be, and those breakdown products need to be eliminated. So, and if you have chronic infection, then you have chronic pus and morbid material, which also needs to be. I have one patient who has a subphrenic abscess, which is an abscess under his diaphragm, and it needs to be encouraged to drain and to all of that material to be delivered more efficiently to the lymph system so that it has a chance. Usually it would be drained and removed by surgery, but he's not fit for surgery. There would be too many complications. And he's much more comfortable. And I would be using a lot of eliminatives for his care. Okay. So this word alterative is one that I am very very partial to. And when I'm teaching the students in Heartward, I teach them in integrated medicine. This is a professional herbal medicine course. They always know to put an alterative as a prescription if I'm the one holding the seminar. So it's experiential learning. I mean, my teachers taught me, but it's only by my experiencing the value of them that it is actually ingrained in me. And very much learning to be a herbalist is an apprenticeship, which you continue long after, long after you pass through the doors of your final clinical exam. So experience has taught us, even if we cannot account scientifically for its significance. So I've drawn a picture of what I see happening, but I can't tell you, right, go to that piece of science and it'll tell you that that's how it works. So this was a particular value to the eclectic physicians. And the eclectic physicians were a group who defined themselves as doctors who would use all methods available, whether it was herbal medicines, they called them botanics. The names of these things change, but the herbs stay the same. So, the other reason is money. If you look at the House of Lords did an assessment at the end of the noughties, and the conclusion was that 0.02% of the research budget was dedicated to the whole of what was called complementary and alternative medicine at the time. I now call it collaborative medicine. So 0.02% of the budget delivers 0.02% of the evidence. And the disincentive is there is no profit motive because plants cannot be patented. All right. So all of those aspects, they're things that, kind of, as I say, I've learned in layers and layers and layers. So when people say to me, where's the evidence? I kind of go, oh, I know where you're coming from. And I can't explain it in a simple way. I've done my best. There's other layers in there as well, which would be exposed in and the forthcoming book, Uprooted Medicine. So watch out for that. So that's it for today, guys. I hope it's insightful. We need to just take all of this with good heart, you know, that if people are working with good heart. But I think we need a change in direction of funding and attention. We need to pay attention to our hedgerows and to our health sovereignty. And our ability to look after ourselves. I think that's the messages from today.
That sounds very positive. If you liked listening to Dr. Dalish talk about her subject today, please like and share and give us a comment. We'd love to hear from you. And of course, if you'd like Dr. Dalish to talk about any subject or anything that's bothering you or you're suffering with and you need some help with, please get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. We are on all the social media platforms and you can go through the website as well and you can send an email. Thank you very much, Dalish. That was another great podcast and we will talk very soon.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Hi. So the word on the street is that Dr. Clare and Tim Morrissey have finally finished their book. It's called Uprooted Medicine and it's subtitled A Revealing History of Medicine That Restores Herbs to Patient-Led Care. And the good news is that you can now purchase it from the website joinedupmedicine, all one word, .com. And it will be available in bookstores from November the 7th because that's when we have our book launch. Our book launch will be in Charlie Burns Bookshop, Middle Street in Galway on the 7th of the 11th at 6 p.m. And we look forward to seeing you all there.